Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
Robert, this week I'm going to let you take the lead here because we're discussing my new book on colonial Florida that's been released, that's available on Amazon, and actually in its first weekend sold more copies than both of my previous books, which were about soccer. So maybe I need to stick to history writing. Maybe that's the lesson. Robert, over to you.
Yes, so we're in a very interesting situation here where the two hosts of this show have a book of their own coming out in less than a month apart. They are book one and two of a ongoing new book series that we are doing at the Florida History Podcast and Florida Squeeze under the Florida Squeeze printing banner. And I'm going to be talking with my dear friend about his new book, Florida and the British Prior to the American Revolution. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm ready
for my questions.
Yeah, I am. I'm ready. Fire away.
Okay. So first off, as you know, I mainly just talk about bootleggers, criminals, and modern politicians. So
which all go together because they all kind of fit.
You know, well, yes, they do. So I just marvel at the breadth of knowledge that you have when it comes to colonial America, regardless of Florida, but just your knowledge of that time period. And so I just got to ask, what inspired you to write this book in particular?
Yeah, so obviously, as you mentioned, I have a real interest in colonial America and in Florida in particular, but I have to be perfectly honest, and I want to keep this as non-political as possible, and I think this is a book that people on all ends of the political spectrum should read and should enjoy. But I think there are extremists on both ends that kind of inspired me to write this book and the subsequent books that are going to come in this series. As you talked about, we've launched a new series of books at the Florida Squeeze and the Florida History Podcast. One is Governor DeSantis, who has completely misrepresented and misunderstood the history of his own state and the experiences that Florida had in the colonial period and during the American Revolution and the early days of the American Republic. I think a lot of Governor DeSantis's views of American history come from his education in Massachusetts and Connecticut, and that's wonderful. I mean, I think he probably reflects a very Massachusetts elite point of view in how he represents American history. And he's written a lot about American history and spoken a lot about it, which I do kind of appreciate. He's done that more than our previous governors, perhaps. But I think he misses a lot of it. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it, Robert, quite frankly, is a lot of people on the left who talk about African Americans and Native Americans and how they what a horrible experience they had in colonial America and in the early days of the United States. They're 100% correct. But for some reason, when so many of these people tell this history, they leave out the fact that Florida was different. And no, we weren't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm just speaking relatively because we still had slavery in Florida. We still had Native American populations being wiped out in Florida. But fundamentally, the way this colony was governed and the way this colony developed, both under the Spanish and the British, was very different than the 13 colonies immediately to our north.
And that, I'm glad you said that, because that was the next thing I was going to ask you. Obviously, there is a wealth of material about this time period and colonial rule, but I'm interested to know what you think as far as Florida. How was Florida different in its development from other colonies at that time period specifically?
So yeah, Florida was different in many ways, Robert. I mean, first off, we got settled first, right? We got settled before the colonies to the north of us. We got settled before the colonies to the west of us in terms of the North American continent. St. Augustine predated Santa Fe, its founding by some 40 years, predated Jamestown's founding by 42 years, predated The Roanoke Island settlement that was abandoned by 20-some years. And in fact, Sir Francis Drake, we talk about this in the book of First British Interactions with St. Augustine, is Sir Francis Drake raids St. Augustine in 1586, 21 years before Jamestown is founded. And he's trying to make his way to the Roanoke colony at that point, which of course we know is abandoned. So, we were older than the surrounding colonies and what now the rest of what now comprises the United States. I would say Quebec was probably 1608 or so. So, yeah, we predated any permanent settlement, European settlement in Canada as well. So in North America, Florida was first. St. Augustine was first. Something that made St. Augustine different and made Florida different was that we didn't have gold. So the Spanish had to take a different view of things. Now, they knew by the time 1565 rolled around that there probably wasn't gold here. Obviously, Ponce de Leon lands or comes close to landing in Florida, 1513, lands in Florida. We don't know where specifically. Hernando de Soto has this expedition through Florida and through the southeast, through what is now the Gulf Coast of the United States, over 3 years, his expedition. We have other landings in Florida between 1513 and 1565. We have the Fort Caroline settlement, which was a French settlement in, we believe, the Jacksonville area, might have been further north. We don't discuss that in the book, but in fact, we don't talk about Hernando de Soto or Ponce de Leon. This is a book about the British and Florida's interactions with the British, which really begin in earnest with Sir Francis Drake in 1586. But Florida was different because it didn't have gold and it was settled first. Also, there was an important spot on the shipping lanes to protect trade from the Caribbean, which became quite lucrative from Latin, from New Spain and the Caribbean to Europe, to the mother country. And then as time went on, we had a situation where Florida's climate wasn't necessarily hospitable to a lot of northern European settlers. So we kind of developed different crops. We kind of developed a different feel. And as time went on, it became a haven for runaway slaves. And the Spanish had a very different attitude towards people of African descent and natives. It wasn't a good attitude. Again, I want to make this clear. I'm saying relative to the way the British and the Americans govern things, so the British and then the future United States viewed these things. The Spanish were relatively speaking more benevolent. They still had slaves. They still didn't treat the slaves particularly well, but there were certain legal rights the slaves had. And in terms of Native Americans, there were things that were a little less onerous that the Spanish did. Now, what did this all boil down to? This boiled down to one thing. The Spanish were interested in religious conversion. And they were interested in Catholicism. And if you were a runaway slave and you, let's say you fled from South Carolina and you fled into Florida, if you said you were willing to convert to Catholicism, that's all they needed to know. Then they would integrate you into their society in whatever way they could. And as it turns out, Florida became, after the 1600s, where Florida was a thriving colony, and St. Augustine was probably one of the most vibrant cities in North America, in colonized North America in the 1600s, and Florida itself as a colony was economically more vibrant than the colonies to the north of us. A disaster struck in Queen Anne's War. You know this well, Robert, living in Tallahassee. That's when the Apalachee Massacre took place. The part of the state you live in, the Tallahassee area, now depopulated completely. The natives are carted off to the Carolinas to become slaves of the British, and the missions are wiped out. Same thing down at St. Mark's. That was another St. Mark's and Apalachee, right? Those were the two areas in your state, your part of the state wiped out. And from that point on, Florida became a highly militarized colony and a colony where the Spanish crown was looking to protect St. Augustine in particular, the capital, and they were willing to accept anyone who would fight to defend the crown or fight to defend the colonies so long as they became Catholic. And I should mention a lot of this was about destabilizing the colonies to the north of them. They figured, you know what, if we can tempt their slaves to run away, promise them freedom, put them to service in our colony in St. Augustine, it not only benefits us, but it also destabilizes our enemies.
Now, a lot of your writing about this time period, because you've written extensively on Florida Squeeze, you've done a number of history articles dealing with this time period. And in your writing, you talk a lot about the multiculturalism that was in and around Florida during this time period, definitely a lot more than in other states, or colonies and territories, I should say. As far as this story is concerned, obviously, I imagine you're probably going to talk about the logistics of the British taking over this area, colonizing it, operating in and around it, governmental infrastructure, etc. But can we talk a little bit about the sort of multiculturalism and the experience that people might have had in, say, St. Augustine during this time period of British rule?
Yeah, it was much more multicultural than any of the colonies to the north. So first off, under Spanish rule, you would see people from Southern Europe, you'd see free blacks, as we talked about, you'd see some Native Americans, you'd see people from Italy walking around the streets of St. Augustine. Some of them were merchants, some of them were artisans, others were doing other services. Now, in the British period, this is what's really interesting, and this is covered more. It's going to be covered more in the second volume to this particular series on British interaction with Florida, which is the portion on the American Revolution. St. Augustine ended up under British rule having a large Minorcan population. A lot of them had come from the New Smyrna colony, which the British had settled with a lot of Minorcans. Now, obviously, they're Catholics, and they're basically Spanish, even though Minorca was at the time a British colony, which is why they were able to export them or tempt a lot of them to resettle in Florida. You had people who were Greek Orthodox, hence the name New Smyrna. It was named for Smyrna in the Ottoman Empire, which at the time was a area with a lot of Greeks. Don't want to get into the history of World War I and what immediately happened after World War I in the battle between Ataturk and the Greeks, but that population ended up being relocated. But at the time, they were on the Anatolia Peninsula. A number of them come to St. Augustine. In fact, St. Augustine has the oldest Greek Orthodox church in what is now the United States, and the Minorcan community has been continuously inhabiting St. Augustine since the 1770s. And in addition to that, you had Native Americans that were mixing more freely in St. Augustine as a town than they did in Boston, New York, Charleston, the big cities in the 13 colonies, Baltimore, Savannah. And you had, again, and this starts in 1775, so there's a period, we talked about the runaway slaves in the Spanish period, that ends in 1763, the British bring a plantation economy, much like they have in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, to Florida. But once the war starts and Florida stays loyal to the crown, you have the lots of runaway slaves again escaping to St. Augustine, free blacks, and not only free blacks, this is really significant, armed free blacks. You don't see that north of Florida at that point. So that was part of the multicultural aspect of it. The British were willing to arm runaway slaves against their former masters, basically, against the American colonists or the patriots that they were fighting. And we'll get into this in the second volume on the American Revolution, Robert, but there's a number of armed African Americans who are part of the East Florida Rangers who go raiding against plantations they presumably may have fled from in Georgia and South Carolina as the war goes on.
So, you mentioned it many times, but just to our listeners, how important in the context of this book is the experiences of Native Americans and African-American slaves going to be for this story?
Oh, it's critical, and I have to give credit where credit's due. Our mutual friend Steve Shale, you know, one of the maestros of Florida politics, particularly on the Democratic side, he turned me on to a place called Fort Mose a number of years ago. Steve is from St. Augustine originally, if our listeners didn't know that. And I thought, okay, you know, what, this is interesting, you know, a little fort in St. Augustine. And this is about 10 years ago, I start doing research on the place. And it turns out that was the first permanent, or it didn't end up being permanent, but the first settlement run by free blacks in what is now the United States. And they were given their freedom, had converted to Catholicism, as I said. A lot of them had taken on these very kind of Hispanic-sounding Catholic names. They were the front lines for defending St. Augustine from invasion. And they were armed, and they were fighting to protect the colony, and they were able to govern themselves, and they were given certain responsibilities that honestly, black people did not have in the United States, or what became the United States again, until the Reconstruction era. So the precursor of Reconstruction was effectively, and the precursor of free African-American governance was in Florida in this period, and the first Underground Railroad effectively, and I think we've done a podcast on this, effectively came through St. Augustine and came through Florida at that time. So they play an integral part in the story, Native Americans as well. We're going to get more into Native Americans in the second volume because the Seminoles effectively become British allies for the better part of 40-something years. Obviously, you and I have just done a podcast series on Andrew Jackson where Jackson is fighting an alliance of the Seminoles and the British, right? And in fact, I've uncovered in my research for this next volume, since we taped those podcasts, Robert, that Andrew Jackson had a direct quote that if we don't wipe out the natives in Florida, it's something along the lines of, if we don't wipe out the natives in Florida, the British are always going to be in our business because the natives are effectively, the Seminoles, this would be proxies for the British, which they in fact kind of became in this era.
So obviously the governing dynamics of not only the British territories, Spanish territories, changed a lot in the 1750s and 1760s. Can you tell us what the British Empire's plans were for Florida from like 1763 onwards, what their goals were for taking over Florida?
Yeah, so they had vibrant plans for the colony. They had seen Florida as potentially, and this is why they wanted Florida, right? They had captured Havana in the Seven Years' War, and rather than keep Havana, they traded Havana back to the Spanish in exchange for Florida. And they saw Florida as a natural extension of both the West Indies, which was, by the way, more economically prosperous at that point than the 13 colonies that eventually made up the United States. They saw it as a logical link between that area of the world, or that area of their empire, the West Indies, and the 13 colonies. And they felt like they could expand the plantation economy that they had in the southern colonies, in addition to growing the sort of crops they grew in the West Indies, and create this kind of fusion of crops and become an important part of the trade within the British Empire, the triangular trade and all of that that was going on at the time, the mercantilist vision for the British Empire. And they had big plans to settle the colony with new settlers from the United Kingdom. That's how New Smyrna got started, as I mentioned. They also had more extensive plans beyond that. But unfortunately, they only had 12 years to do this, and they were not very far along in their plans for Florida when the Revolutionary War breaks out, which is where this first volume, this book, ends in 1775. Little teaser for the next volume. I've mentioned the number of runaway slaves that came to Florida and being armed by the British. There will also be a major influx of Tories or loyalists, whatever you want to call them, from other parts of the 13 colonies or from the 13 colonies into St. Augustine, fundamentally changing the complexion of St. Augustine overnight, really late 1775, early 1776, completely changing the town and forcing the British to abandon their long-term plans for colonization in Florida and focus on to subjugate the 13 colonies to the north. And Florida, again, a teaser for the next volume, Florida would play an important role, often an overlooked role by American historians, less so by British historians, but an important role in the British war effort against George Washington and the Continental Congress and the 13 colonies.
Now, you mentioned Volume 2 quite a bit. I made everybody wait about 4.5 years for the second volume of Rum Runners, probably a little too long. when can we expect Volume 2 to come out? Not to rush you, I know you just finished Volume 1, and, you know, but when do you think you could see yourself releasing Volume 2?
If you're a movie buff, you'll get this analogy. It's like Superman 1 and Superman 2, which if Richard Donner had been able to produce Superman 2 also, it would have come out almost simultaneously. I had written a lot of the Revolutionary War. This is the, and you know this as a historical writer, you sometimes work backwards. So quite frankly, about 70% of the second volume is done already.
Wow.
And it was, most of it was done before this first volume was done, because I kind of started with the Revolution in mind, that being the big British thrust in Florida, and then realized, oh, geez, I've got to go back and go through the origins. So basically what just has been published and has been released, which has a very low price point for a reason, it's $4.99 for the paperback, $2.99 for the Kindle edition, is it's basically a very short primer, which is going to get you ready for the second volume and the Revolutionary War, which I know is a topic people are fascinated by in all elements in this country. And so Volume 2 should be out. I don't want to make any promises here, but I'm guessing I will be done with it in a few months, and it will be out by the end of 2023.
Outstanding. So where can everybody purchase your best-selling new release?
Yeah, thank you. It's quite high on the charts for Colonial America. It's already in the top 40 for books on Amazon for Colonial America. Unfortunately, right now, as we record this, it is only available on Amazon. Amazon.com, go look up the book or look up my name and you'll my author page, and you'll find the book $4.99, as I said, for the paperback edition, $2.99 for the Kindle edition. And I've really been gratified by how many people have read the book early on and have said, oh, wow, this is history we didn't learn in schools or we didn't know about. Because, again, I think American history has been taught in a way that cuts Florida out of the experience and out of the conversation. And that's my beef with Governor DeSantis, right? I mean, like I said, his view of history, of American history and Colonial America, might be perfectly acceptable from the point of view of the two states he went to school in, went to college in, but it's not one that appreciates and respects Florida's role in the foundation or in kind of the formation of the United States.
And not to seem like a shameless promoter here, but a lot of our listeners are people that are new to Florida or have a passion for Florida. Quite a few of them I know have Florida, you know, bookcases that they just collect books on works of Florida history. This is a wonderful addition to those collections. I can tell you, totally biased, by the way, but you know, in looking at segments of this book, it really is covering an area that is not talked about, and it is a essential chapter to the narrative of Florida that has gone chronically underrepresented in the telling of Florida. And so it is a very fascinating work, and I'm very, very pleased that you have made this the first release of our new Florida Squeeze book series that we're going to be doing.
Thank you so much, Robert.